Welcome, everybody.
Thank you. I think we're just about ready to close the doors. Yep, we are. Okay, welcome to the concurrent session on strategic disinformation. We have Shauna Ferris from Macquarie University, who's got a strong interest in financial history and research interests in the area of prudential regulation. And she tells me she knows a lot of people here because she taught them at some stage. So I'll hand over to Shauna. If I could just remind you that there is a session feedback form that you got in your red bags. If you wouldn't mind filling that out and completing it so that at the end of the session, as you leave, you could put it on the chair at the back. That would be fantastic because it just helps having to sort out all the different session papers from the return bins into the actual sessions that they come from. So that would be very helpful. I'll remind you again a bit later. Mobile phones to silent or off, please. And over to Shauna. Thank you.
So maybe just tell them 40 minutes to look, so okay. I can make sure. Go quicker if I'm running out of time. Well, thanks to all of you for coming along today to listen to me talk. I know there's lots of other really interesting sessions on. So today I'm going to talk about strategic disinformation. And during the last global financial crisis, I realized that sometimes regulators say things that they may be sorry for later. And this is my list of famous last words from regulators. This company is well capitalized. Which company do you think that one is? This company is adequately capitalized. This company is healthy. This company is in no imminent danger. This company is and always has been solvent. This bank is solvent, exceeds its regulatory capital requirement, and has a good quality loan book. There is no reason for people to withdraw their funds from this company. So I don't know if anyone want to have a guess which comments relate to which companies. First one's IndyMac. It went into receivership about 6 weeks after. About 6 weeks after they announced it. This is what the regulator said about it. The regulator said it was well capitalized. Second one is Bear Stearns. I don't think they lasted a week after the regulator said this. This company is adequately capitalized. That's Fannie Mae. This announcement was made in July, and they were in receivership by September. This company is healthy. That's what Henry Paulson said about Merrill Lynch. This company is in no imminent danger. This one's a bit older, Executive Life. That was a life insurance company in the US that went bust in 1991. This company is and always has been solvent, is the Equitable in the UK. The next one is the press statement from the Financial Services Authority about Northern Rock. They lasted 2 days after this statement. There's no reason. I thought I'd better put in one Australian one example, so I'll put in Pyramid. That's a pretty old one that most of you won't remember, but it was a building society down in Victoria that went broke back in 1990. So I guess these are all examples of cases where the regulator has been trying to provide some assurance to the general public about the health of a financial institution, which really wasn't in very good financial health at all. So what I got interested in this because of the very different reactions. In some cases, regulators are given a really hard time about making comments like this, and in other cases it's accepted that it was understandable that the regulator said that under the circumstances because he was trying to do his best for either the general public or the company. So I've been collecting as many stories as I can and as many case studies about how regulators reacted during some kind of financial crisis. And some of the stories go back 100 years to the banking crisis back in the 1890s, and some, of course, are much more recent. And what I'm trying to do when I look at these studies is actually just see how often regulators give way to the temptation to provide some misleading information and find out what they were thinking. Luckily, some of these regulators have actually written their little memoirs explaining what the process was and what they were thinking about when they made these decisions about how to deal with the crisis. Actually, next is, how do regulators mislead the public? Sometimes it's just by making the kind of reassuring statements that we've seen, and in other ways, other times, the regulator is considerably more subtle in working out how to convince the public that the company's still solvent. The next question is, how well did it work? Was it really effective? If you think about trying to provide reassurance to the public, if you saw an announcement on the TV that said, you know, the head of APRA has just released a statement saying there's absolutely nothing to worry about Bank XYZ, would you say, well, I know APRA would never lie to me because they're honest, reliable people, or would you go and take your money out the next day? Past experience is that people are often quite unwilling to believe regulators when they make comments like this, and they may not be as effective as the regulator hoped for. And the last question was the independent review. After one of these occasions, there's usually some kind of scrutiny of how the regulator handled the situation. So I looked also at what came out of that review and whether people felt the regulator had handled the situation appropriately. I don't have time to go through all of them today, but I'm hoping that some of you will get interested enough to look at the paper when I actually finish writing it. I'm sorry to say I thought this would be a short paper when it started and there'd only be a few cases for me to look at, but it turns out that the number of regulators who issue misleading comments is actually a lot more than you'd think. So it's now quite a long paper. So theoretically, of course, disclosure is a good thing. I don't think there's any need to talk about this too much because every regulator puts out various policy statements saying how important it is for companies to disclose their financial status and all of their risks, and disclosure requirements are getting tougher and tougher and tougher all the time. So it improves market integrity. People can feel confident they know what they're investing in. It improves market efficiency, making sure that companies that are managing money well get more customers. And it should improve market discipline. It should provide, this disclosure should provide an incentive for companies to make sure that their risk management standards are high and that their solvency standards are high so that they can continue to attract customers. And prudential regulators usually are in favor of disclosure because it's the third pillar of the prudential system, that market discipline helps keep companies safe. But disclosure does have a downside. And I guess when you talk about market discipline, you think of market discipline as being a firm but gentle parent, you know, giving a child a smack when they get a bit naughty and encouraging them to do better. But in fact, at times the market becomes a bit more like a homicidal maniac. And if they find a company that is not behaving well, they tend to not give it a gentle smack, but take an axe and chop it into little pieces and feed the bits to the dogs. So the Bank of International Settlements describes this very politely as saying that the markets may react harshly to bad news, especially during times of when markets are fragile. So the question, of course, is why not? I mean, if you had your money in a bank and you heard that it was not well managed or didn't have enough capital, why wouldn't you take your money out? You would expect that the market, that customers, not just the share market, but customers will be quite sensitive to any negative news they hear. I mean, there's really no reason why they should stay with a company or a bank that is insolvent or even rumored to be insolvent. So a financial institution has a natural incentive to hide bad news. And, of course, in many cases, the regulator often has reason to hide bad news. I mean, there may be very good reasons why the regulator wants a financial institution to continue in operation, at least for a limited amount of time, and that's generally called regulatory forbearance. So if the regulator has decided that it is best to give a company time to trade out of its difficulties, and rumours are flying that the company is in financial difficulties, how's it all going to work out? Some of the banking papers written by the Bank of International Settlement say regulatory forbearance may be transparent or not transparent, which means that you can try to let a company continue an operation without disclosing that it's got any troubles at all. So two questions I'm going to look at are, should there be disclosure of any intervention by the regulator? And if there's already widespread public concern, what, if anything, should the regulator say? So normally regulators are pretty good at keeping things confidential. In fact, it's required that they keep things confidential, and that's the only way our prudential regulation system will work. If you don't want the company to be hiding its problems from the regulator, because you would prefer that the company works with the regulator. So confidentiality is essential. And in fact, normally problems are resolved very quietly, and APRA seems, according to APRA anyway, APRA's pretty good at this. Looking at some paper David Rush put out a while ago, they reported on how they were going with handling entities that were in trouble. So an entity that is in mandated improvement is operating in an unsustainable way, and a financial institution that's classified as restructure is in serious danger of failing. And these were the statistics presented, and you can see that out of 144 that were in mandated improvement between 2003 and 2008, 80 of them had very quietly exited the market. I didn't even know that there were 80 companies quietly exiting the market without causing any disruption to the financial system. I must admit, the first thing I saw when I saw this was, there are 144 companies out there in trouble. I wonder if I have any money invested in one of those. But same thing with the ones in restructure. 39 were in restructure, in danger of failing, and 29 of them had quietly and orderly exited the market in hopefully a fairly orderly fashion. At least I didn't see any really terrible headlines in the newspaper. So generally, a lot of financial institutions get into trouble. There's never any fuss. And the regulator just quietly and confidentially deals with it. Now, looking back, I tried to look back at some banking crises from the past. And one that I came across was the UK secondary banking crisis in 1973 and 1974. I'd never even heard of this banking crisis before, which just shows you what a great job the regulator did. This was in the UK. They had a thing called the Lifeboat Plan, where the Bank of England quietly persuaded the other banks to provide liquidity. He just called the heads of all the other banks into the office and told them they weren't going home until they coughed up some money, basically. And the Bank of England put in 10% of the money as well, and they bailed out 26 banks and put in more than £1.2 billion into the financial system in support, liquidity support. And the book that describes this said, one of the most striking aspects of the crisis was that many people were unaware that there was a crisis at all. The losses, actually that should be 150 million, the losses were estimated at about 150 million, but the banks that participated in the bailout said, well, it was worth it because we prevented a systemic crisis, and if we had to put in $10 billion towards our contribution, it was money well spent. To prevent destabilisation of the financial system. Same thing again in 1991 when BCCR went down. They also organised a very quiet little support scheme. They never announced anything. They bailed out about 60 banks, and they didn't say a word about any of them. But these days it's, of course, much harder to do this kind of thing because we have much stricter disclosure requirements. So when Northern Rock got into trouble in the UK in 2007, the Bank of England governor said, look, I really wish I could have just done all this really quietly. We used to do it really quietly. we did it quietly in the 1990s. I wanted to run a covert lender of last resort, but when he talked to his legal advisors, they said, no, you're not allowed to do it secretly because we have disclosure requirements now. The company itself would have to reveal that it had received assistance. So they put out, on the legal advice, they put out their reassuring press release, which said, yes, we are going to provide liquidity support to Northern Rock. Don't worry, the company's solvent, everything is okay. We're just helping them out with this little liquidity problem that they've got. And, of course, the immediate result was not good. The immediate result was that the news that they were going to provide liquidity support leaked, and the run started as soon as the news hit the airwaves. The question is, once the public knows that the Bank of England is providing liquidity support, would you leave your money in that bank? They've issued a very reassuring press release. And the answer was, most people decided no. They took out a billion pounds on the same day, which was 5% of Northern Rock's deposits. They took out another billion pounds over the next 2 days. And they really, the run didn't really stop until the government announced a full government guarantee of all the deposits in the bank. So then the run stopped. So after this all happened, the Northern Rock chairman said he was really, really surprised that all these people kept taking their money out, despite the fact that the Bank of England had said that everything was perfectly okay. So I guess despite the fact that there were all these reassurances about the bank being solvent, it did not have a sufficiently reassuring impact on the customers of the bank. So this is just a quote from an old bank regulator from the US. There's probably no better and simultaneously more self-defeating indication that a bank is in trouble than an advertisement indicating that everything is fine. And that was based on his experience in winding up quite a lot of American banks. And as after the research that I've done, I'd have to say, if a regulator said such and such bank is perfectly fine, I'd go and take my money out the next day. Sorry. I mean, I know APRA is very trustworthy, but as people would say, you know, why take a chance? And there have been cases like this in Australian history as well. Some of you might know the story about the Hindmarsh Bank, which Hindmarsh Building Society, which got in trouble down in Adelaide 20 or 30 years ago now. And the bank was actually in perfectly, the building society was actually in perfectly good shape. They managed to get liquidity support from a bank, but despite this fact, once rumours started about the bank, the building society, people rushed to take their money out. And the Premier of the state actually went down and stood outside the bank with a loud hailer saying, there is nothing wrong with this bank, our regulators have checked it, it's perfectly fine. And they played the footage on the news that night, and the next day the queues outside the bank were longer because it made people aware that there was possibly a problem. And no matter what the Premier said, they didn't want to put their money at risk, even if it was only a small risk. Why would you want to leave your money in a bank where there was any doubt at all? So the result of this situation at Northern Rock was to say, wouldn't it be better if we had a little less transparency? And the regulators in the US have put out, in the UK have put out a white paper saying what we want to do is have a bit more secrecy for regulators. The Bank of England should be able to give emergency liquidity assistance in secret, and the banks should not have to reveal any such assistance. So they put this paper out for discussion and asked for comments back. First comment was from Charles Goodhart, who's a very renowned expert in banking. He used to be a banker himself, now he's an academic. And he said, we've just spent all reams and reams of paper saying how important good disclosure and transparency are to avoid creating systemic risk, and now you're saying you want to go back to having more secrecy. You know, he was against the idea. They said it was unfair to anybody else who's lending money to the bank to not know that the Bank of England has become a creditor. Charles Goodhart also said, on principle, it's not good to let the government hand out billions of dollars secretly. It's just a bad idea in principle. And the most pertinent comment was, it doesn't really matter because you won't be able to keep it secret anyway. As you could see from Northern Rock, the news leaked out like 10 minutes after they'd made the decision to lend them the money. It was on the BBC. So it's very difficult to keep this kind of thing secret. So at the moment, there's apparently a Bank of International Settlements Committee looking at the problem of stigmatization, that when the regulator actually does something to help a bank, it can make the situation worse because accepting the help indicates that you're in trouble and the market overreacts. Now, looking at the American solution to this problem was interesting because they also had the problem that they had a lot of banks in trouble who didn't want to accept help because that would just create a stigma. So during the global financial crisis, the world was in a very shaky situation. Bear Stearns had gone down, Indie Mac had gone down, Freddie and Fannie had been put into receivership, Washington Mutual, Lehman Brothers, AIG. They'd all been getting heaps and heaps of money. Confidence was at a very low point. And in October, there were concerns that Merrill Lynch would be next and maybe after that Citibank, and who knew what would happen after that. So Henry Paulson decided that he wanted to build up confidence in the American economy, build up confidence in the American banking system, but he didn't just want to give out money to banks that were in trouble because then everyone would know which banks were in trouble. So what he did was he used the camouflage approach. He called 9 of the most systemically important financial institutions to come to a meeting in Washington. And he said, here's $125 billion. It's from the government. This is compulsory capital injection into your company. Take it. And they didn't really get any choice. They were told, basically, you can take it voluntarily or your regulator can make you take it. It doesn't really matter. So they all decided to accept it voluntarily, using the term voluntarily loosely. And the review of this situation later said the main reason they wanted all 9 banks to take the money was to avoid stigma. They wanted all 9 of them to take the money because otherwise it would make it obvious which banks were in trouble. It seems to me like this is a very expensive way to achieve camouflage. I mean, basically, they ended up giving like $80 billion to banks that probably didn't really need it. They didn't give it to them. It was a capital injection, and they earned some interest on it. But it shows a fairly desperate attempt to conceal or make less transparent the measures of assistance. And interestingly enough, some of the banks didn't want to take the money because they were afraid it would cause a stigma. So Henry Paulson assured them that he would put out a press release saying that they were all healthy. So this was put out by the Treasury, the FDIC, and the Fed. It said, these are all healthy institutions, and they have taken this step for the good of the U.S. economy. None of them really needs the money. We're just giving it to them so that they can have more lending and boost the economy, which was, in fact, not actually true, because you would have to have a really unusual definition of healthy to say that Merrill Lynch and Citibank were healthy, unless healthy to you means on the verge of collapse, because that's really what the situation was, that they're on the verge of collapse. So after this all happened, they have this guy called the Special Inspector General of the TARP program, and he pointed out that Citicorp and Bank of America were not healthy because they both needed another $20 billion within a few months, not to mention government guarantees for all their toxic debt. Someone asked Mr. Paulson later, did you really think they were all healthy? And he said, well, some were healthier than others. He doesn't strike you as the kind of guy that's got a sense of humor, but after reading some of his stuff, he did in fact admit that he was pretty worried that at least one of them, probably Citicorp, was going down the drain. But he felt that he had to make this statement. So The Special Inspector General, this is one of these after-the-event reviews, put out his report commenting on Treasury's actions and saying, we really don't think that it's a good idea to tell lies to the public. He didn't put it quite that bluntly, but that's kind of the gist. It's important that even during a time of crisis that the government officials should be careful to describe their actions and the rationales for their actions in an accurate manner. And he said, because if they don't, then next time there's a crisis, no one will believe a word that the government says, and that will make it much more difficult to handle the next crisis. And it will breed distrust between the American people and their government officials. He asked for the Treasury and the Fed to comment on this report. The Fed said, we agree with you, we really shouldn't have done that. The Treasury said, well, you know, we did what we had to do, and we don't really care what you think. They didn't put it quite that bluntly, but that's kind of the gist of what they said, is that they were dealing with a crisis, they had to do what they thought was best, and there's no point in the SIGTARP second-guessing them because they did what was necessary. So that's an interesting... we might skip over this. There was some controversy about the Merrill Lynch takeover, but you should ask me about that later because we don't really have time to talk about it now. So let's move on to what do regulators do when the general public already suspects that one or more financial institutions is in trouble? And so this is the scenario. The financial system's in a fragile state. Particular institution, XYZ, is known by the regulator to be in an unsatisfactory financial condition. The regulator is unable or unwilling to resolve the situation very quickly, usually unable, especially if it's a large financial institution. It's very hard to do something fast. So the regulators decided we'll have to let XYZ continue operating in the meantime, and there's very likely to be good reasons for that decision. But the problem is that at least some members of the public are aware that there are problems at XYZ, and there's a danger that a run will occur, or perhaps it's even already started. And the run, of course, is likely to have quite disastrous consequences, not just for the economy, but for the regulator, because whenever there's a run like that, it's usually considered a failure of prudential regulation. So unless the run can somehow be stopped. So what can we do in this situation? The theoretically correct response that is usually in the policy documents is the regulator does not comment on the financial status of individual financial institutions. And I noticed our own regulators were very circumspect during the recent financial instability and didn't make any comments about any particular financial institutions, as far as I can tell. They just made really general comments. But in practice, regulators do often give way to the temptation to try and reassure the public by strategic misinformation, which is the dictionary definition, is misleading information supplied intentionally. And in the case studies I'm looking at in my paper, the regulators sometimes just allowed the financial institutions to provide misleading information, or the regulators provided misleading information themselves, or sometimes both. So when you look at a financial institution that's in trouble, there are a bunch of pretty standard things you can do to hide the fact that you're in trouble. Overstate your asset values. Don't write down your asset values after a crash. Don't set up bad debt provisions. Make your intangible assets get counted as assets for solvency purposes. Use a slightly higher discount rate. Ignore some of your contingent liabilities. Just assume that you're going to win the court case. Misclassify your assets or liabilities into a lower risk weight category. Use financial reinsurance. Backdate some capital infusions. These are pretty standard. I mean, I hope nobody's taking notes out there. Should try that one. And during normal times, regulators usually kind of frown on this kind of behavior and discourage financial institutions from doing it. And in fact, if you do this kind of thing, you're actually likely to get in a fair bit of trouble. And at least several visits from the regulator. But, in fact, during a financial crisis, the regulator himself may be encouraging financial institutions to do this. And I have to say, in the case studies that I've looked at, regulators have used every single one of these approaches to try and conceal problems in the financial institutions. IndyMac, this one isn't in my notes, but IndyMac is actually an example. In the weeks before IndyMac went broke, the regulator actually told them that they should backdate a capital infusion so that they could still claim to be well capitalized, and apparently also told them that they should misclassify their subprime debt so that it would be have a lower risk weighting so that they could reduce their minimum capital requirements. And the Inspector General did an investigation later and found that the Office of Thrift Supervision, who's the regulator for IndyMac, had actually gone around to some other banks and told them that they must backdate their capital infusions so that they could look more solvent. This was frowned upon. So here's an example. Some of you might be familiar with the less developed countries crisis in the 1980s. The US banks lent way too much money to Central and South American countries. They were encouraged to do so by the US government as part of the foreign policy. In 1982, Mexico defaulted, which created a big bad debt problem for the US banks. They adopted a slightly controversial approach to this, which was to lend the South American countries more money. The regulator who was the chairman of the FDIC has written his own memoirs about this experience, and you can see there's often a in these situations there's often a conflict between the prudential regulator and the systemic stability regulator, and this was definitely true. The prudential regulator, the FDIC, was telling the banks, don't lend these guys any more money, but the Foreign Policy Department and the Federal Reserve were encouraging them to lend more money to South America. They said, if their banks close on Monday, our banks will close on Tuesday because we owe them so much money. They owe so much money. So this just led to even bigger bad debt problems. And it raised the issue, should the banks set up realistic bad debt provisions? And if they had done so, 7 or 8 of the top 10 U.S. banks would have been insolvent. So the FDIC guy said he was encouraging realistic reporting, but the Federal Reserve said, no, if people publish accurate accounts about their bad debts, we will have a financial meltdown. So this memoir describes the controversy between the two of them. Apparently, Citicorp said that they were planning to, Citigroup, I think it was then, said that they were going to write down their Mexican debts by 30%, and the chairman of the Federal Reserve rang them up and said, don't do it. We really don't want you to acknowledge this kind of problem. William Seidman, who was this guy, who was the regulator, said the regulators looked over the abyss and decided they should take another path. So this is quoted as an example of a case where regulators definitely tried to help financial institutions hide their solvency problems, and it worked out quite well. The banks did eventually recover. I guess the shareholders who bought shares during that period might have suffered an unexpected loss later, but they achieved their objectives. It was effective. Savings and loan crisis is a less effective example. In the early 1980s, roughly 90% of the U.S. savings and loans were insolvent. The Deposit Guarantee Fund, which was supposed to wind them up, did not have enough money to actually wind up 90% of the industry. And President Reagan had just come in, and he said he had a very strong political philosophy of we don't bail anybody out, and we don't want to have a budget deficit, and we'd prefer the guarantee fund just doesn't ask us for any money, so you better find some other way of dealing with the problem. Let them trade their way out of trouble. They should be more entrepreneurial. So regulatory forbearance was basically the only option. They didn't have enough money to close them down. There was no political will to close them down. In fact, quite the opposite. So the regulators really didn't have too much of a choice. So the result was... what is, depending on how polite you are, it was called regulatory accounting principles. They basically just changed all the accounting principles to say that all these companies were solvent, even though they weren't solvent. There's quite a lot of technical stuff, but basically you could count thin air as an asset. What happened is if you had a loan on your books that was defaulting, and say it was on your books for $100,000, you sold it to someone else for $50,000, you'd actually be making a loss of $50,000. But they said you didn't have to put that into your accounts. You could write off the loan slowly over the next 10 years, 5,000 at a time. So you'd have an asset on your books of $50,000, which actually didn't exist at all. And there are lots of other accounting tricks that were used to help show that these companies were solvent. This did not turn out well. I'm not going to go into the whole savings and loan crisis, but it helped companies conceal their insolvency while they got deeper and deeper into more insolvency. So for most some companies did recover, but most of them didn't. Now, when regulators make misleading statements themselves, it's not a good idea to lie, because lying is clearly wrong and usually leads to bad consequences if you lie. So fortunately, it's not really necessary, because a carefully worded half-truth can be sufficiently misleading to achieve your objectives. Sometimes there are noticeable... What comes out afterwards is sometimes there are noticeable discrepancies between what the regulator is saying in public and what is in their internal memos. I don't know if the moral of this story is don't put anything in internal memos, but my favourite example of this is from Executive Life back in 1991. The public statement was published: Executive Life is in no imminent danger, but someone was taking notes at the meeting, and they wrote down that the regulator who was responsible said, Executive Life is hanging on by its fingernail. Executive Life was in receivership. 4 months later, it was one of the biggest life insurance companies to collapse in the United States ever, and had a deficit of $4.5 million. And if you're a regulator and you want to encourage your junior regulators to be more careful about what they say, you should get them to read the part of the congressional inquiry where the regulator is asked to explain exactly why he made that statement. It was obviously a painful experience for the regulator to have to go through the congressional inquiry later. But he did have good reasons. He thought it was Executive Life had a huge deficit, right, because they'd invested a lot of money in junk bonds. But the regulators thought the junk bond market is bound to recover soon. And if we can just hold on, if we can just prevent a panic, this company will probably recover. And in a way, they were right. The junk bond market did recover, but it recovered way too late for Executive Life, because there was a run. People knew that Executive Life had a lot of junk bonds. There was a lot of negative press. People took their money out. They didn't last long enough to recover. So, case study, Fannie and Freddie. Public statement. The regulator has confirmed that both the GSEs remain adequately capitalized. Henry Paulson testimony to the Senate Banking Committee. Privately, this is bullshit capital. He said this. He admitted this later. That statement was made in July 2008. They were taken into conservatorship early September. All the shareholders' capital of $80 billion was wiped out by subsequent losses, and the government provided a capital infusion of $150 to bail it out. So I can see you sitting there thinking, how can someone say that the company is adequately capitalized when it actually needs $150 billion just to survive? So they asked Mr. Paulson about this later. How could you say Fannie and Freddie were adequately capitalized? And he said, I never said they were adequately capitalized. I said that the regulator said this. See, he does have a sense of humor. But that leads us to the next question, is how did the regulator say that they were adequately capitalized? And the answer was that there's this common misunderstanding that adequately capitalized means has enough capital. But that is a complete misinterpretation of the term adequately capitalized. It just shows your ignorance if that's what you think. Because what it really means is this company, which has an established record of accounting fraud, has reported that it has surplus assets, which are largely composed of intangible items such as future tax benefits for past losses, which will never be claimed, which are sufficient to meet the regulatory solvency requirements, which are ridiculously inadequate relative to the risk due to many years of intensive lobbying. So, see, this is the trouble, because words can be quite ambiguous. And the regulator was perfectly correct when he said that Fannie Mae was adequately capitalized, using his definition of adequately capitalized, which kind of leads us to think maybe we should think about the terminology we use and how people, what we mean by it, and what the ordinary member of the public would mean by it. Now, people who are, why did they do this? I mean, it's easy to make fun of them. I enjoy making fun of them. But when you look at it, they really didn't have much of a choice, because in 2007, subprime debt crisis had already wiped out most of the private mortgage market. All those big subprime debt lenders countrywide, and they were all out of business. And Fannie and Freddie had to make more loans in order to fill the void left by the collapse of the subprime lenders. They were, quote, the only game in town, and otherwise the U.S. housing market would have collapsed. There were politicians banging on the regulator's door saying, you have to let these guys lend more money. So there were two, once again, there's a conflict between the objectives of the regulator, the OFHEO, which said, these guys don't have enough capital, they shouldn't be taking any more risk. And the Treasury, Mr. Paulson again, who said, in the public interest, they have to take on more risk. Okay? So we have the situation where it was a very fragile economy, a large systemically important financial institution, grossly undercapitalized, must make more loans in order to save the housing industry, and obviously needs to raise more money to do it. This is not a good time to be going around saying things like, they don't really have enough capital, you know. So you can see there was an incentive to present a rosy picture of the financial status of the two GSEs. I want to just check on how much time I've got. So the consequences were, you know, how effective is it when they make comments like this? And the answer was, most sophisticated investors didn't really believe a word that they said. The share prices plummeted. The spread on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac debt securities was getting wider. They were having trouble rolling over their debt, which is like a silent run. They were having trouble getting a source of funding. So it didn't really work. The government ended up having to take them over just so that they could keep raising more funds to do more housing lending. It did work on the unsophisticated investors who lost everything. Anyone who had preferred stock in Fannie Mae and Freddie, it went down to 1 cent on the day after the takeover when it was announced. And most of these investors were small banks and savings and loans. The regulators had encouraged them to invest in Freddie and Fannie preferred stock because they were such nice, safe investments. Banks that put all their spare cash into Freddie and Fannie preferred shares had low risk weightings for calculating their capital requirements. There were no limits on how much they could invest, and the result was that 10 banks went insolvent and 74 more became impaired. They had about, out of the $36 billion that preferred stock for Fannie Mae, about $16 billion was held by other banks and savings and loans. So I guess from Henry Paulson's point of view, these guys were just collateral damage. They might have lost money, but it was necessary for them to lose money because we had a global financial crisis. So, yeah, okay. The investors pointed out that there were some double standards here. If you were the CEO of a company and you went around saying, oh, we have lots of capital and we're perfectly financially sound, and then you were bankrupt a few weeks later, you would probably go to jail for securities fraud. But the rules are different for regulators. My last case study, which I'll do really quickly, I might have to skip over some of this, is the Equitable. Some of you may know a lot about the Equitable and some may not. The Equitable was... The Equitable was one of the biggest life insurance companies in the UK, $33 billion worth of assets. And they were going through a very bad time in the 1990s, lots of very negative publicity. They closed to new business in 2000. The policyholders were very concerned about the stability of this insurance company, and they kept ringing up the Financial Services Authority, which was the regulator, saying, should I be taking my money out? And the FSA decided that they would provide some reassurance. They set up a website to answer questions from concerned policyholders. They wrote standardized form letters for dealing with inquiries. And the website and the letters all said, don't worry, the society was and always has been solvent, and the society has always met and continued to meet all regulatory requirements. But, I would have to say, there was a lot of doubt about whether the company was solvent. The Parliament, after the whole fiasco collapsed, the Equitable is still in business, but had a lot of difficulties. The Parliamentary Ombudsman was extremely critical of the Financial Services Authority for making these statements, and said they should have realised that the assurances that they were providing to the policyholders were unsustainable on the facts and were misleading. Her paper on the Equitable was called A Decade of Regulatory Failure, which just gives you a kind of feel for what... it's like a 500-page report outlining every single thing that the regulators and the Government Actuaries Department did wrong in the regulation of the Equitable, but I'm just focusing on the disclosure issues here. And I don't think we've got time to go through all the details. But basically, let's see how I can say this. They were teetering on the verge of insolvency for years. Company had a policy of keeping its reserving levels as low as possible and paying bonuses that were as high as possible. And this doesn't make a company very safe. They sold deferred annuities by recurrent single premiums. The money would go into an account, it would earn interest, and at retirement you can convert it to an annuity. But during the 1990s... they used every trick in the book to try and appear more solvent than they really were. Basically, the way they did this was to mortgage their future profits. They moved their expenses into the future, they moved their debt repayments into the future, so that they could bring forward profits as much as they could so that they could declare higher bonuses. So... they continually overcredited. They'd pay bonuses that were too high. This was part of their smoothing policy. The recommended approach to smoothing is that you hold back some profits now to supplement bad times later. The Equitable used the opposite approach. They paid higher bonuses now in the hope that they would earn some more money later on to help pay for them. So the amount of bonuses they credited were higher than they could actually afford to pay. Which meant that future profits would be needed to pay past bonuses. The regulator let them use a future profits implicit item, which was £1,000 million. And basically this was saying, we think that our business will be profitable in future. We'll use the profit margins that we expect to earn in the future to supplement our reported solvency condition this year, which basically meant that the future profits might be needed to pay existing liabilities. They had a subordinated debt where they'd borrowed $346 million, and, of course, that meant that future profits would be needed to pay the subordinated debt. they had a financial reinsurance contract. In 1998, they realised, the Financial Services Authority recognised that the Equitable had a large contingent liabilities arising from selling guaranteed annuity rate policies, and they had not set aside any reserves to cover those guarantees. And if they had been required to set aside an appropriate amount of money, that would have made the Equitable insolvent. And the Equitable said, we don't want to be insolvent. In fact, we would like to declare a bonus this year. And the regulator said, no, there's no way you can declare a bonus. You're broke. And they said, well, we'll get this financial reinsurance contract, which they put on their books as being worth $800 million. And they said, that's okay, we'll pay the money back out of our future profits. They also used a fairly dodgy accounting rule, which was actually illegal, to push their new business expenses into the future as well. And the new business expenses would be paid out of future profits. So as you could see, the future profits would be used for paying off the overcrediting, covering adverse experience on current liabilities, paying back the subordinated debt, paying back the FinRe arrangement, paying unrecouped expenses on existing policies, and if there was any money left over, they might actually pay bonuses to the policyholders. The main problems being that there weren't any future profits because the company was closed to new business and then the share market collapsed. So the company was, you know, really pushing the envelope in solvency management. And the criticism of the FSA was that they actually let them get away with it. Some of the adjustments were actually contrary to the regulations, inappropriate, unjustified, and just plain not legal under the regulations. Without all these adjustments, which the Financial Services Authority approved, the Equitable would have been insolvent. So when the FSA was putting out press releases to all of its policyholders saying the company was insolvent, they should have said, well, it's insolvent if we let them do this and this and this and this and this, which we probably shouldn't be letting them do. So I'll skip over the next couple of slides. The next problem they hit after that was they got sued for mis-selling and had to set for almost potential liabilities were almost unlimited. And, of course, since it was a mutual, the only people who could pay for the compensation were the other policyholders. So the final result was that the FSA encouraged a new board to come in. They slashed the policy values by more than 30% over the next year, which was necessary to put the policy values in line with the actual assets the company held. This wasn't actually a breach of solvency conditions because the bonuses were not guaranteed bonuses. They were all terminal bonuses. Policyholders are not very happy, which is why there's been about 12 investigations into the Equitable since then. The main problem was that during the period 2000 to 2001, the FSA repeatedly assured the policyholders that the Equitable was solvent on the letters and websites, but the internal memos revealed that the FSA staff had serious concerns about solvency. There's just, you know, dozens of memos quoted where they sometimes they say they're insolvent, and other times they just say it was very tight. They were obviously feeling that there was some uncertainty there. The parliamentary ombudsman said, look, the regulator didn't have to say anything. There is no obligation, no legal requirement for the regulator to say anything. But if they did say something, it should have been complete, accurate, unbiased information, especially in a country which bases its whole regulatory system on freedom with publicity. The government recommended that $1.5 billion should be paid to policyholders by the government in compensation for the maladministration by the regulator. So the question, I guess, if we had time to discuss it, which I don't think we do anymore, is why did the FSA keep saying that the Equitable was solvent when they knew that this was, at best, an optimistic statement? Do you want to tell me what you think? Would you have done the same thing if you were the FSA? What were their other options? I mean, it's one of the biggest life insurers in the US, in the UK. They had desperately tried to find buyers for the company to take it out in a way that would be beneficial to the policyholders. No one wanted to buy it. not once they looked at the books anyway. A few people were interested until they did a due diligence and they said, oh, thanks, no. So did the FSA actually... What were their options in dealing with this problem? If they let the company continue going in operation... and there's no public confidence, what's going to happen? Some people are going to bail out. The membership will gradually decline. It'll be worse and worse for everyone. Did this actually have a good outcome? I mean, what happened is the new board came in, they slashed all the policy values by 30%. Was there something better that they could have done?
Perhaps they lacked the courage to close it down
early. Closing down a life insurance company with all those annuitants... They basically said, well, we could have closed it down, but basically we would have had to put someone else in to manage it, ourselves, and would they have done a better job? So how do you deal with this? The parliamentary ombudsman was very... she said, look, I don't want to have a go at all these regulators. Well, she did actually. She did have a go at them, but she did say that she recognised they had a very, very difficult job to do. And that there were competing pressures and interests. And it's easy for us to criticise and say they should have done something better, but the regulator was basically in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. And one of her main conclusions, which I don't think I've got there, is what we really need is to have some better guidelines for what regulators should do when they're in this position, instead of... waiting for them to do something and criticising it later, there should be some policy guidelines in advance. If we're dealing with a situation where you want a company to keep going in operation, it's weak. If it's publicly known that it's weak, that's the end. Is there anything better that you can do? So I don't know what the answer is, but I found it very interesting looking at all these cases, and if you're interested in them, I'll try and... I think I put my email up here, actually. you can send me an email... and tell me what you tell me if you know any more good cases that I should add in. So there's my email address there if you want to send me any messages. I think we're out of time, right?
Yeah, we're going to be... there's time for a couple of questions if people have got questions or comments that they want to add to that.
Any regulators here who want to tell me what they really do in practice?
I was living in the UK at the time, and one of the things that I saw from outside was the brand awareness of Equitable and the fact that it was the book of annuitants, but there was just... it was impossible to believe that it would go under. There was the public sentiment to
support
it.
It had been around for 238 years.
Yes, yes. It was a brand. Everybody just held it up as being, the bee's knees, everything they did, and it was... a lot of it was to do with the impossibly high bonuses they paid.
Mm. A lot of actuarial their actuaries writing a lot of papers saying how they ran it without an estate.
That's right, yes.
Other
right.
Companies were excessively conservative and ripping off their policy.
Yes, actually, yes, it did, yes. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
They paid really high bonuses to themselves.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, the result of their paying really high bonuses was that they had to slash their policy values 30% when things went wrong.
Yeah.
But maybe they would have thought that was okay according to their business model, but the question is, did their policyholders understand that was what was going to happen?
Yes, it's true. So as it's time to finish, I'd like to ask all of you to thank Shauna for what was a very interesting presentation. It's very good indeed. Very interesting. And I'd also ask you to fill out your session sort of feedback forms, please, if you wouldn't mind. And if you leave them on the chair or the bench at the back there, I'll collect them and hand them in en masse. But thank you very much.
Thanks.